I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes about a book, then Kianga and I are going to be in conversation and we'll open it out to the audience. And I want to start with something that I saw. It was either in the cab or I only arrived yesterday and I was up at 4 o'clock. So I, you know, if I fall over in a small heap, just pretend nothing happened. Be very British. I will get up at some point. I saw this report about Ronald Reagan in conversation with Nixon, and he was referring to Africans as monkeys. Nixon was laughing. Then Nixon passes this joke on to somebody else. And you see this endemic racism at the very height of the American polity, and the degree to which, while what we're seeing now is different and new, it is not. Trump is a product of American racism. He didn't invent it. And the degree to which people have been able to kind of accommodate American racism within the polity, which has been stretched to a point that is now kind of untenable, I think. And that one of the things I thought was interesting was that the people at Reagan's library, the people, they said, well, if he said that, then it was wrong. And it's like, he said it, it's on tape. But also, you know that in, what, 60 years' time, Trump's people were like, yeah, he said that. Yeah, of course he said that. He said what he said. And that, in one sense, what we are seeing is the outside voice of American racism in politics coming out in a particular, like a hardy virus that we have yet to find the most effective antidote for. And that really is a place to start with why I bothered to do this. This book is a collection of my work from 1994, which is when I started in journalism, to 2020. And it's called From Nelson Mandela to Black Lives Matter, because that really does bookend my career. I started in 1994 at The Guardian with a contract. The Guardian was caught in a classic liberal dilemma in the run-up to the South African elections, which is that they needed somebody young, black, and cheap to send South Africa to get stories that white journalists couldn't get in townships and elsewhere. And they were smart enough to know that, but not smart enough to have actually employed black journalists that they wanted to send, or kind of black journalists, really. And the extent to which that they were wise enough to know that is that I was the only black journalist from Britain, Europe, I would imagine, who did anything in the 1994 South African Mandela campaign. In January 2020, I left The Guardian to become an academic. In May 2020, George Floyd was murdered. And so the work in the book is from Nelson Mandela to Black Lives Matter. That really does basically span my career. Now, it starts with not the first piece I ever wrote for The Guardian, but the piece that got me my job, which was covering the following Mandela around in 1994. And well, I had my 25th birthday in Johannesburg, and I couldn't drive. And this was, in Britain, not such a big deal, really. But in South Africa, it was. So I had to catch lifts from different people. And in the process of catching lifts, at one stage, I go to a rally that Mandela is speaking at, and somebody drops me halfway back to Joburg, and they said other people are coming through. The other people that were coming through were his bodyguards. His bodyguards had studied in the Soviet Union. I had studied in the Soviet Union because I studied French and Russian. I'd been involved in the anti-apartheid movement. I'd been involved in something akin to the communist movement in Britain as a teenager, as had they. We had stuff to talk about. I was also, I made it my business to amuse them. And so I ended up stumbling into Mandela's entourage. Yeah, they would say, like, come along with us. They let me come along and watch them as they cased a few joints. They would sometimes have me in the car. Sometimes I would be in the stands. And so I had this incredible access, which, frankly, I didn't know exactly what to do with it. But I wrote this piece, and this piece got me my job. And it was an incredibly hopeful moment where when I was in the stands, not in the entourage, people, he was always late, Mandela, and you would be in these areas where apartheid had put people. Often, there was little, if no electricity. Often, people had never seen him. They might have heard his voice on the radio, but they'd never seen him apart from on a poster. And then he was coming. And what you would see from the distance, because they were always in, you know, godforsaken areas, was just the dust kicking up from his entourage, from his cavalcade. And then the ululations and the dancing would start, and it would be old women with no teeth, children with no shoes. They would just, the whole place would go nuts. I hadn't seen anything like it. And you could see it from a long way away. You could always see it from a long way away because they were always in remote areas. And then he would come and he would do a couple laps. And it was an incredibly, incredibly moving experience. And the book is divided into four bits. And the first, which is called Change Is Gonna Come, involves the more hopeful moments. Obama's election, the Notting Hill Carnival, and it's about the black diaspora. It's notes from dispatches from the black diaspora. So Europe, continental Europe, Britain, Africa, and black America. The next chapter is called Things Fall Apart. And in that, I go back to South Africa 5 years later and I talk to people and we talk about the disappointments of the Mandela era. And I lived in America for 12 years. I examine like Barack Obama's legacy. I go to Zimbabwe and write about the kind of degradation of Robert Mugabe and the leadership there. And Trayvon Martin's, the acquittal of George Zimmerman and so on. The next bit called Ways of Seeing is my attempt at times to just shift the focus of how we understand what we're seeing, why we're seeing it, and some of the catches that I think are in and the snags in our thinking. So I write an essay in defense of Uncle Tom, the character, not the slur, but the character. If you've read the book, then I actually think he's a pretty decent, he's a decent individual. But also I have a problem with the slur, actually. I think that if people are wrong, they're wrong. And if they're right, they're right. And that Uncle Tom, to me, is a bit like self-hating Jew or West Brit, which is what Irish people call Irish people who they think are too friendly to the Brits, that, like, actually essentializing people and saying you are this kind of person and therefore you should think this, I think is a real problem. I also think that black people have the right to be as wrong and as stupid as anybody else. And it's quite an important right to defend, actually. People talk a lot about black excellence. I am a real advocate for black mediocrity. I think it's a terrible burden to feel that we have to be excellent all the time. I write about statues and why I think all of the statues, actually, we should just take them all down. Even the ones of Mandela, even they don't work. They are ugly, mostly. They venerate individuals of the collective. Statues of living people, not Rodin. And then there's Bridgerton, which I have a problem with. White History Month. I do one. I'm assuming that you have all seen Boris Johnson. You know what he looks like. And so one of the articles is about, just let's just imagine if Boris Johnson was born a black woman, what could and couldn't have happened. And so the degree to which every single leg up he had was because of his race and his gender and his class. And then his ability to make the most appalling mistakes and get away with it. The one thing that I regret in that piece is that I didn't talk about his hair. Imagine a black woman with f***ed up hair like that, getting anywhere in the world. The next one is called Express Yourself, and it's interviews with some of the more prominent people that I've done. The one that I'm most proud of is my interview with Claudette Colvin, who was Ejected from the Bus before Rosa Parks. That came out in 2000. She's become a bit considerably better known now, but at the time, she was literally a footnote. There was no decent story of the civil rights movement that would not mention her, and there was none that would give her props or actually kind of just let her speak. So I spent 2 years trying to find out who this woman was, who was kicked off the bus before Rosa Parks. She was the one that they were going with. She has letters from people in Seattle. She grew up in Montgomery, working class, dark skin. She was the one, but then she got pregnant and they just dropped her altogether, and she dropped out of history altogether. So it took me 2 years, and she was a nurse's aide in the Bronx. She's still alive. It took me 2 years to find her. But I interview Angela Davis, Maya Angelou, who I was supposed to have 45 minutes with her, and 14 hours later, I roll out of her limousine, out of my head. She less pissed because she could take a liquor better than me. And this starts with, we're coming back from an event that she has, a performance, and we get caught in this terrible LA traffic jam. And then she turns to her assistant, Lydia Stuckey, and she says, "Can we have some whiskey, Miss Stuckey?" She says, "Do you want ice and stuff, Miss Angelou?" And she says, "I want a little bit of ice and a lot of stuff." And it just keeps coming. Stormzy, who is not as well known in America as he might be, who a brilliant grime artist, the closest, he's a rapper, that would be the closest approximation, big supporter of Jeremy Corbyn. I found him a very kind of clever and interesting guy. So, yes, Express Yourself, which is these interviews. And then finally, Me, Myself, I, which are personal essays, personal reflections. And I'm going to read very quickly because it will move on to what we're going to do from one of them, which is the last column that I did for The Guardian as an employee here. This was me signing off. And it's worth knowing it comes just a month after Boris Johnson's elected in a landslide and everybody blames Corbyn for everything. When I was a child, my mum used to put on the song Young, Gifted and Black by Bob and Marcia, put my feet on hers, and then dance us both around the living room. They're playing our song, she'd say. It was the early 70s, she was barely 30, and I was the youngest of three children she was raising alone. Struggling to believe there was a viable future for her children in a country where racism was on the rise and the economy was in the tank, she'd considered returning to Barbados. But unable to do so, instead, we danced around the living room, singing ourselves up, imagining a world in which we would thrive, for which we had no evidence, though we did have great expectations. Much of the politics that's informed my writing in this column came from my mum. It's partly rooted in her experience. She came to Britain just a month after the Commonwealth Immigrants Act was passed, which was a piece of racist legislation. She came because the Health Minister, Enoch Powell, in Britain had embarked on a colossal program of NHS restructuring that required more nurses. As such, she was living proof of the immigrants that the British economy needs, but its political culture is too toxic to embrace. For her, sex, race, and class were not abstract identities, but forces that converged to keep her wages low and her life stressful. But my politics is also rooted in what she made of those experiences. She was an anti-colonialist and an anti-racist, an internationalist and a humanist who would never have used any of those words to describe herself. Race conscious as she was, most of her community activism took place in the working class white community where we lived. They were her people too. She made me stay up and watch the Holocaust miniseries, which completely freaked me out when I was 10, and took me to watch Gandhi, which was way too long, when I was 13. And both times she told me, "This is your story too." She believed the world she wanted to create was never going to come to her, so she would have to bring the fight to it. I saw her confront the local fascist candidate, the police, and her union, to name but a few. Even in her sudden and untimely death, there were valuable lessons. That life is too short to waste time on people you don't care about, but long enough to make a difference if you want to. She was 44, I was 19. So she never got to read my columns. So my presence in The Guardian would have been, I think, as unlikely to her as anything else she hoped I might achieve as a child. I sign off from this column at a dispiriting time with racism, cynicism and intolerance on the rise, wages stagnant and faith that progressive change is possible declining. That sound familiar? Even as resistance grows, things look bleak. The propensity to despair is strong but should not be indulged. Sing yourself up. Imagine a world in which you might thrive, for which there is no evidence, and then fight for it. Thank you.
That was great.
Thank you.
I love the Maya Angelou story.
So did I.
Tell them at the end.
Sorry?
When she drops you off.
So very pissed with Maya Angelou. And she drops me off in this limo, and she, as it's pulling away, she pokes her head out of the window, and she has the energy of a, like, 9-year-old girl, and she goes, "Your place is swanky. You live in a swanky place." Like, that's just kind of just... And it's like, bye then. So that was the end of me, you know, visiting one of the kind of major icons for me was this kind of elderly woman shouting jokes out the back of a car.
I've heard that story 46 times and it's still hilarious. Gary, so let's start. I actually wanted to start with where you left off. 2015, your last column for The Guardian. Gary and I both lived in Chicago, which is where we met. And I left for the East Coast in 2014, and then you guys left in 2015. Mm-hmm. And so 10 years later, basically, what do those words mean now? Like, in the article itself, it's about really... At that point, the high point of Black Lives Matter. So this is the summer of 2015, which of course is a year after the murder of Mike Brown, the fall of protests that turned Black Lives Matter, transformed it from a kind of regional protest in Ferguson, Missouri, into a national movement. There's riots in Baltimore in May.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dylann Roof murders 9 Black people in church in South Carolina. And then Trump.
Yeah.
The day after Trump announced his campaign and called Mexican nationals rapists, Dylann Roof went to the church and killed people. And so 10 years, what do you make of where we have landed?
Yeah, I mean... It's intriguing to me because when I left in 2015, it was obvious to most that Trump couldn't win. It seemed obvious. And he was a ridiculous figure and no one was going to buy that. And the logic in the Republican Party was, we have to reach out to the Latinx community. If we don't, we're finished. That was the logic. But already you had seen the kind of the backlash, even though... So often when these backlashes come, you think, but where was the lash, you know? And that, you know, there had been these demonstrations, there had been a rise in consciousness, but what was most intriguing to me at that moment was that there was a Black president and he was the picture on the barbershop, in the diner, but he was almost irrelevant to the conversations that were taking place around racial justice. He felt irrelevant, and to the extent to which he was irrelevant, he wasn't helpful. And it was also, when I left, Britain was in the European Union, you know, and this was a really kind of quite obvious thing for us, an obvious place for Britain to be. And so when I went back to Britain, people were saying to me, "Are you leaving America because of the racism?" So I was like, "F*** sake. Yes, I'm going back to Hackney in London to avoid racism. There is no racism in Britain." And that delusional notion that so many Europeans have, and there is there is an essay about that in the book, that racism is a kind of artisanal American product that you can't get anywhere else, like Parmesan or Champagne. It kind of comes from this place. And that... So I go back to Britain and people are like, well, yeah, you know, I bet you're glad to be here because it's so bad being black there. And then Brexit happened and then people said, oh, I'm, you know, it must be awful to be back now. And then Trump got elected and then they went back to like, oh, it must be really... And it's like, look, these are two racist countries at war with themselves and the rest of the world. Like, this is not a journey between one nice place and another place. But that the things that we are seeing now... You could sense the seeds of them, but it wasn't evident how far they would go. And there was an assumption that there were checks and balances would not be quite the right term. But yes, that there would be, that there were some, there's some guardrails. And also, when it came to the black diaspora that we were building, particularly here, because Black Lives Matter didn't really come into force in Europe until 2020, that a resistance was building. And that how I see those 10 years is that actually on both sides of the Atlantic, in different ways, a significant amount of political space was cleared by the left, by anti-racists, by, but they cleared space, but they didn't build on it. Mm. And so we have this contradiction where on the one hand, most of the polling has been showing, and I don't know about the polling now with Trump in power, that in both countries, people were more aware of racism and more convinced that it was a bad thing, say. And at the same time, we were getting more racism. And the other thing that had happened in both countries and elsewhere in the Western world, certainly, was a different kind of resistance. Corbyn, Bernie Sanders, Die Linke in Germany, in most of Europe, there was a resurgence of the left. And so a different narrative was coming up about how we might understand the situation we were in since the 2008 crash. And we saw the political class in most of these places absolutely
strangled,
terrified, yeah, and murder the baby in a bathtub before it could really get anywhere. And we are suffering the consequences of both of those setbacks, I think. I mean, how do you see those 10 years?
I did a podcast thing with Astra Taylor and Naomi Klein last week, and Naomi described a scenario where we're living with a counter-revolution without actually having had the revolution.
Mm.
And, you know, I think that was accurate. We had a long period of radicalization. I mean, I talked about 2008, but in rereading parts of this today, I thought about what you described, the whirlwind of your 12 years here, landing here during the Iraq War, and how that war is related to a kind of deepening political cynicism that then boils over with the 2008 crisis, but also the significance of the 2008 crisis is that it helped to shift the blame away from ordinary and working class people who had been consistently blamed for two generations for being poor, for being marginalized, and focused it on the parasite class, the bankers and their greed and recklessness. And in many ways, that opened up or cleared the space for different kinds of formations in which Occupy Wall Street developed, but also Black Lives Matter. And I said this last week that movements don't win just because they should or because they're right or that they have better politics. And if we don't win... The losses are tragic, and we're dealing with that now.
I mean, it's also possible, I think, to win the argument and lose the politics. Do you know what I mean? I feel that, that has really happened. And I think that a critique I would make of Black Lives Matter, which would be the same critique that I would make of Occupy Wall Street, Me Too was different, but I would say about that as well, which was that these things, they burn very brightly and they do have an impact on people's understanding. And then they fade. There's a kind of homelessness to these moments. Mm-hmm. And then they are kind of reformed. I don't know, there would be a high percentage of people who were involved in Black Lives Matter who weren't involved in Occupy Wall Street, but there would be a high proportion of people who were involved in Occupy Wall Street who were involved in Black Lives Matter. And so we keep moving from thing to thing, but never actually establishing a base for any of them, or them actually kind of synergizing into kind of one thing. So my guess is that there will, sooner or later, God, I hope sooner, a significant anti-Trump movement will emerge that will have echoes of the last anti-Trump movement, but won't be, you know, we'll have none of the infrastructure, if there was any infrastructure. So you just keep on reinventing these wheels one at a time. And, you know, you don't get very far on a unicycle. Do you know what I mean? You have to keep, you need more than one wheel. Without wanting to torture the metaphor, preferably a vehicle, you know, it could take you somewhere.
So if you could talk some about your experiences with fascism and anti-fascism in Europe. I was saying earlier, before, that, you know, you have this essay where you write about the growth of parliamentarian fascism in Europe in the late 20th century, so 98, 99. And it's sort of woven into the daily politics of daily life. And I think the antics over the last 4, 5, 6 weeks of this new Trump administration has prompted discussions in the U.S., this fascism, authoritarianism. What do you derive from your experiences with fascism in Europe to make sense of what is happening here right now?
Yeah. So in the book, I make a trip around Europe in 1998. And I think to really get this, you have to know, I studied French and Russian. That was what my degree was in, which is how comes I'd studied in the Soviet Union, as per the previous story about Mandela's bodyguards. And in 1984, I go to the Dordogne in France, in southwest France. I'm 15, and it's the back end of a school exchange. We've done a school exchange, and then my partner says, come over in the summer if you want to come over. Or actually another kid says, come over in the summer if you want to come over in the summer. Someone that I'd got to know when I was there. So I come over, and cut a very long story short, I'm kicked out of the house at 15 by his dad, who is a fascist, which is a surprise to this kid as well. Not that his dad was he just didn't think his dad would go that far. And I have to spend the rest of my holiday as a 15-year-old. He comes in a room with a tent, and he says, we have a problem, and he's been crying. And then we take the walk to the campsite, and I have to wait at the campsite till my mum can send me some money so that I can pay for the campsite, because I hadn't assumed that I would need that, and for the food, and then kind of come back. This was the year that the Front National, I think, got about 8%. And it was like, oh, my God. And, you know, Europe was, you know, this is terrible. But it seemed like an aberration. By the time I make this trip, there are fascist parties getting 10, 12% around Europe. We are now at a stage where they're in government. They are in power in Italy. They came second in Germany just at the end of the weekend. But in that piece, in 1998, I say fascism is now once again a mainstream ideology in Europe, which in historical terms did not take that long between the camps, like 50 years. And they're like, what? Well, you know, yeah, okay, so we're fascist, you know. And it's like, but you tried that. It didn't work. Or to the extent to which it did work, it wasn't good. And my reading of Europe, and this is in another essay in there, is that the key differences with America are that the worst of our most egregious anti-Black racism took place somewhere else, in Ghana, in India, wherever. And the best of our civil rights movements, the most robust, took place somewhere else. And so there is an implausible deniability that Europeans have around where they've been and what they've done. In 1948, the year that the Windrush boat came to Britain with, it was a historical moment. It wasn't Plymouth Rock because they weren't genocidal. They were Jamaican servicemen coming to Britain for work. And it's seen as the beginning of post-colonial migration. And there is an aphorism by a British, late British radical, Sivanandan, explaining immigration. He says, but we are here because you were there. But of course, if you didn't know that you were there, then how do you understand why we're here? So in that same year, in 1948, there was a poll done by the Colonial Office, and it found that half of British people could not name a single colony. This at a time when it ran much of Africa, most of the Caribbean, and a significant part of Asia. Half of British people couldn't name a single colony. One person said Lincolnshire, which if anybody knows anything about Britain, is really mental. That is like Americans saying, isn't Idaho a territory or something? I mean, it's mental. And so there has always been this kind of capacity. And in a way, we... this isn't a boast, it's just a reality. We had the first Trump, which was Berlusconi, a very rich man who was absolutely shameless.
Totally.
Sexual predator, sexually incontinent, ridiculous hair, orange... orange face, just too much time on a tanning bed, who completely, like, looted the country and undermined its democratic institutions, got into lots of legal trouble, and was still elected. And then we kind of, you know, we had a few versions of that with Le Pen and so on. And so when Trump comes along, particularly the second time, he is painfully familiar. Actually, in some ways, this go-around, he's somewhat behind the curve. That we've had elections over the last couple of years in Holland, in Austria, in places where fascists have topped the poll. They don't always win the election because we have proportional representation, but they've topped the poll. And they are finding themselves in each other. So Elon Musk, AfD, he called the AfD to congratulate them. They've had a Make Europe Great Again conference, which, as you said earlier, like, when are they talking about? And I have this image of them. It's probably Bridgerton, you know. There's probably, like, you know, big wigs and dress coats. And so this moment that America's having is a global moment, which in all sorts of ways, you can have Geert Wilders in Holland or the True Finns in Finland or Nigel Farage, who's just kind of like a drunk uncle at a barbecue, British racist guy who runs Reform Party and spends most of his time here, actually. But American power is different. That Americans aren't saying, look at what those Finns are doing. We should do that. But the victory and the Trump's victory and the way that he's being parlayed is absolutely emboldening the right, the far right in Europe. They don't speak exactly the same language. And there was an interesting moment this week where Bannon's Sieg Heil was too much for the French Front National. Like, I didn't know there was such a thing as too much for the French Front National, but there was a guy who was supposed to come to CPAC and he was like, well, I can't do that now. But in all sorts of ways, particularly around migration and Islam, they are kissing cousins. And it makes it, what's happening in America makes it terrifying because it caffeinates what's happening in Europe.
And conversely, the institutionalized opposition, how do you explain the utter ineptitude, the just disgusting patheticness, the just...
You're trying to think of something bad enough.
The Democrats are so bad, we have lost the capacity of language to describe whatever that is.
Yeah, and I mean, it's infuriating. And it's this is also a theme, right? So the right and the far right come in Germany on the back of the Social Democrats.
Right.
At the moment in Britain... Labour won. They won with less votes than Corbyn got when Corbyn went down in flames, but they won. And now the Reform Party, which is the Nigel Farage character, is outpolling them. And this speaks to the point we talked about earlier about this left resurgence that was crushed.
Yeah.
And you see that these people, they stand for power, but very little else. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like they had a response. It's not like they had an idea to confront. Honestly, if you were in Britain during the Corbyn period, it was a pretty milquetoast social democratic agenda was what he was suggesting. But that was too much. And it had to be not just stopped, but traduced, maligned, murdered. And anybody who was associated with it. It was a very interesting kind of moment to be a journalist, because just to not trash Corbyn was enough to have to fight for your credibility. Just to not trash him, let alone to say, even he might have a point here about X, Y, or Z. And so they kill these things, similarly with Bernie. I always wonder how the American polity and the political class and the media class would have responded if Bernie had won in 2020 and then January the 6th had happened.
And told the courts to f*** off and, you know, fired all the generals.
And... Well, if he'd done that, that would have been the end of it. But I guess akin to that, if he had won and then January the 6th had happened, I think the political class and the media class would have been like, well, you know.
Free speech.
Yeah, it's kind of what happens. They're extremists, he's an extremist. And so they defanged what was a kind of energetic, plausible opposition, but replaced it with nothing. And actually, what they've done, certainly in Britain, I think here, they've either been paralysed, which it feels like they have been here, or in Britain where they're just chasing them. So they're saying, look, we are so much better at being xenophobic than you. And they frame it in managerial terms. Mm-hmm. But then nobody speaks up. And this is the point I was making about my mum and the economy and so on, is that they don't seriously want immigrants to stop coming, these leaders, because they understand that the economy is absolutely dependent on them, that the National Health Service would collapse, that care homes would collapse, that there's a range of things that... But they want to change the terms of the people coming, make sure they're scared, get rid of their rights, and then frame that in a racist way to satisfy their base. And there are some uncomplicated arguments about this that just aren't being made and that have left them with a kind of a free rein. And honestly, I look at America in particular, the Trump stuff... Predictable is not quite the right word, but he's not doing anything. I thought, oh, my God, I don't believe that. Whereas the idea that this mainstream center party, which called him a fascist just a couple of months ago, is now like, well, what are you going to do?
Welcome home.
Yeah, what are you going to do? The response to Trump last time from abroad, they're coming to get me. Last time I was supposed to do an event in this space, I was not allowed in the country, which may or may not have been related to the fact, even though it was before October 7th, that I was also then going to go on and do a pro-Palestinian event. So you never know. There seemed to be more of a vigorous response in the immediate wake to Trump's election in 2016. And abroad, I haven't seen that yet. What response is there and where will it come from, do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, if you remember 2017 when Trump was inaugurated, I mean, there were tens of thousands of people in the Capitol in Washington, D.C., but I think somewhere 3 million, more than 3 million mobilized in marches across the country. And then there were international demonstrations as well. And so there hasn't been anything like that. I think there are different dynamics. I think that he won the election, he won the Electoral College. He won the popular vote, not by the landslide that the Republicans continued to say that he did, but he won. I think there's also a level of exhaustion. I mean, the Trump administration, there are two features, lasting features of that. One is the kind of venal corruption and all of the antics associated with Trump. But the other thing was protest. There are more demonstrations and protests during the Trump administration than I think any other period in American history. Mm. And we know that the 2020 protests, according to the New York Times and others, that these were the largest demonstrations in American history, with millions upon millions of people in big cities, small towns, all across the U.S. And so, you know, I think if you protest vigorously and you protest historically and nothing changes, it's kind of hard to just gin that machine up again without there being any particular political direction or objective. And I think some of that has to do with understanding what happened to those protests and the way that they were easily absorbed into the Democratic Party, the presidential election, Joe Biden in 2020, the Georgia Senate races, and really the kind of devil's bargain that you go home and will kind of solve these issues. And Biden, you know, the Biden administration couldn't deliver that. Of course, they did things. Mm. It's not true that nothing, the Democrats, Biden did nothing in office. But relative to the scale of crisis that had been exposed by COVID and that had been exposed by the kind of brutal lynching of George Floyd, it wasn't enough. And I think that that's kind of where we've been left of what do we do that's effective and not just protests for the sake of protest, but what do we do that's effective? And I don't think that that means that demonstrations and protests aren't effective. They are. But there has to be a different political objective than just, oh, we got to get to the midterms, and then we got to get to 2028. There has to be something other than that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm struggling at the moment with the issue of, say, in Britain, Labour, which some people are saying that they're no different to the Tories, and they are like, no, you know, that nothing has happened, and all that, which is not true, I think. And to separate what our problem is, what our main problem is, electorally, really, or in power, which would be kind of the Trumps of this world or the Reform and Nigel Farage, and the obstacle, which I feel, like all of that energy that was poured into Labour under Corbyn, where did it, you know, where did it go? What was that? And one of the things that's been interesting to me, and it's a bit of a work in progress, this, but the French left were incredibly skillful a non-sectarian intervention that really thwarted. I love to see fascists cry. And after the French election, they were in tears. They were in tears because they thought they were going to win. And thanks to the French left, which said, if there is someone who's not a fascist, we will stand down. And the way that French elections work, it makes it easier because everyone can stand at first. And then you have to get, I think, 12.5%. In order to stand in the second round, and it's a person who wins in the second round. So he said, look, everybody stand, you want to stand, but then get out of the way for the person who can be the fascist. And that was the left's idea, and the centre under Macron were deeply resistant, and they weren't going to do it. And in the end, it was like, look, it's going to be on you then. And so they came in behind it, and the French left did so much better. Mm-hmm. So then, of course, they were frozen out of the government, which is now failing. Differently, but interestingly, in the German elections, and I don't know how much of this reached here, but the Die Linke, the left party, did quite well. They doubled their vote.
All the women.
Sorry?
they got the woman vote.
And that came, their fortunes changed when a woman, I think her name is Heidi Reichenecht, she made this speech in Parliament And she called it out. She called them out. And she said, look, this is on you. And the fascism that's coming is on you. And she was talking about the center-right party. There was a norm in Germany that you didn't pass a law if you could only pass it with far-right votes. And they breached that to pass this anti-immigration law, which they could only pass with AfD votes. And she ripped them a new one. And she ends the speech by saying, to the barricades. And you can watch it on YouTube. And frankly, you don't even have to understand German to get it. Because she, you know, she's going for it. And I think their slogan was something like, others want to manage, we want to change things. Or others want to govern, but we want to change things.
Yes.
And it hit a note. And we don't want to, I would not want to over-egg that pudding. They went from 4% to 8% or something. But that's 8% supporting a solid anti-fascist left agenda. And that's 4 to 8 in about 3 weeks. And it turns on that speech. So, which says to me in both cases, most people don't want this.
Right.
But in the absence of an alternative, and here is where Europe is interestingly different, Britain being more like America, actually, but the rest of Europe, is that in America and Britain, the voter turnout was low, and it was mostly about people not showing up.
Right.
In Europe, the voter turnout has been higher than usual in most places, including Germany and also France. And that is partly about right-wing people showing up who don't show up before, but it's also about left-wing people showing up who didn't show up before, particularly the young. So there's hope, and the hope is in some ways in the most obvious place, which is resistance. That if you can mount a viable resistance and a principled resistance, and quite importantly, a non-sectarian, that was, to me, one of the lessons of France, was there was a great quote when Le Pen in 2002, when he reached the second round of the presidential election, and there was a guy, he was a communist, who was going to vote for Jacques Chirac, who was a right-winger. And he said, when your house is on fire, you don't care if it's dirty water to put it out. And we want to separate that from the lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was ever a time for coalition building and non-sectarian politics, it's now. Because whatever differences there may be in this room on the left, they are nowhere near the differences. Look at what these people are doing. And interestingly, I think, the centre-left did not deliver. I mean, they delivered some here. They're delivering nothing in Britain at the moment. But these people aren't going to deliver either. It's not going to be that long before people realise that changing the pronouns on government emails is not going to reduce the price of eggs if that is why they vote for Trump. That their lives, you can make the lives of black people, of immigrants, worse if you want, but it's not going to make your life better. And this man is not going to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
For a significant section of his base. So then there is a fight for the story about why he doesn't deliver. Like, there's only so often you can blame DEI for everything. And we have to be ready, both with a response and organization sounds too formal, but with an infrastructure that can say, look, here are some answers and here are some ways.
Right.
And we're nowhere near that yet, certainly in Britain. But I do think that you are seeing elements of it, France and Germany being examples of places that are showing the way.
I do think that one of the things that has developed in the last week or so is that a lot of these Congress people, representatives, have gone back to their districts and had town hall meetings. And people, you know, have shown up angry. They're all these great clips of older people who are shouting down these congressional representatives, but also some of the authoritarianism. I know at one of these town hall meetings, and I think it was Coeur d'Alene in Idaho, these security people who aren't even cops wrestled this woman out of the meeting because the Republican rep didn't like her question. And so that went viral. And so there are these different, I don't know the degree to which it's coordinated or organized, but it is kind of this like outpouring of both representatives, but also federal workers who there have been organized protests. So I think the elements of an opposition are there. It's like, what are the strands that actually pull it together into a kind of self-aware and self-conscious opposition that is explicitly trying to become bigger, but then has political objectives that go beyond an election. So I do think that the elements are there.
And I feel like one urgent part of that is to kind of keep it away from the Democratic Party and its priorities.
Yes.
That, like, not, you know, vote Democrat, don't vote Democrat, that I don't care about particularly. But that in terms of crushing the energy and the hope, the last thing we want is like, yes, that is a very good point. And in 2022, or whenever, 2026, I will make that point.
Yes.
I will make the point. So you just hang on in there with your no job and your kid in the cage and, you know.
Send me $5.
yeah. This is your contribution to the resistance, like, is by direct debit. That we can't be, I mean, it hasn't worked. And it's not like it was a surprise that it hasn't worked, but now it hasn't worked. Can we please move on to something that is effective and as big as it might be?
Okay, I do want to ask you about diasporic politics. What's going on with Black people around the world?
Yeah.
And all this right-wing nonsense. Just tell us about the Black world.
Okay, we've got a few minutes. So here was an interesting thing that I was involved in. 1884, there was a Berlin conference. This is relevant to your question, I swear. 1884, there was a Berlin conference. So as the 140th anniversary of this conference, and a Berlin conference is where they carved up Africa.
Yeah.
And say, okay. I mean, a lot of it was already taken, but it's like, right, we're going to draw these borders, we're all going to agree. Like, it was like a group of thieves sitting down and just making sure that everybody had the right cut. And 104 years later, on the anniversary of the conference, this group in Germany, the Coloniale, had a conference which was a descendant of this disaster. So I was representing Britain. There were people from the Congo, from Namibia, from Rwanda, from across the world, and other Black Europeans, Austria and elsewhere. And one of the interesting things to me, this would have been 2 weeks after Trump, something like that, Trump's victory, was it didn't come up. And the reason, I mean, it's difficult. When things don't come up, then you are left interpreting why they didn't come up, right? Because they didn't come up. But I think that what they had seen from America was like, well, and I'd be interested to know now with USAID and all that kind of stuff, what they would say now, but was like, yeah, we can see it's a big deal for them, but they've been f***ing us for years. And this is not kind of, that was my interpretation. This is a new... This is a difficult moment for America. We can see that. But actually, in terms of the trajectory of our lives, well, you know, they weren't doing much for us. Actually, what they were doing was really terrible. And they talked about how Europe was expanding its borders, so making African countries enforce Europe's borders. So giving African countries money, which they need, and saying, but for that, you have to make sure that people don't leave here and come to our place. And that was intriguing to me. First of all, it didn't come up. And in any other conversation that I was having in Britain or elsewhere, particularly with white people, it was coming up. And in the same way that Obama's election did ripple through the diaspora, so this moment, I think, is rippling through certainly the minorities in the West diaspora, that they can feel the chill. And actually, they've been feeling the chill for a while. And so where it would have been most likely to have come up would have been among the Black Europeans as opposed to the Africans. And that there has also been, and this speaks to a kind of dislocation between the developing and the developed world, which Black people are involved in that dislocation. So in Britain, the leader of our Conservative Party is a Black woman called Kemi Badenoch. The Conservative Party are, at the moment, at their most racist, at their most awful. She's talking about kind of not all cultures are equal. Some are, you know, some are diminished. They have talked about flying legitimate refugees. Not that it would matter if you weren't, but flying them to Rwanda was their policy, that they'd done a deal with the Rwandan government to fly refugees to Rwanda. And I found this often in America with African-Americans. I found it a tricky conversation. The notion that you might be both oppressed at home and be privileged globally was often not a comfortable conversation. It's a slightly easier conversation in Europe because mostly our relationship to the developing world is more recent because we are more recent immigrants. So we will have aunties and uncles or grandparents or something who are in Ghana or Nigeria or the Caribbean in my case. So that offers a different kind of potential. It feels to me like the 60s being the high point of this, there was a moment at which the black diaspora was having the same conversation. How do we get the vote? How do we get equality? How do we get these people off our backs? That was when Fidel Castro goes to Harlem and stays in the Teresa Hotel. And at that UN summit, only 13 countries vote for colonialism. Of course, Britain and America being two of them, either voting for it or abstaining on racial tyranny. And since then, there has been a slow and logical kind of divergence, but I think it's become quite acute. So I would say mostly that there are meaningful ways in which you could talk about a diaspora, I think, but that the cleavages in those experiences are becoming so broad that they are becoming difficult to kind of reconcile.